Welcome to NB Publishers Book Nook. In this episode, Nancy Richards sat down with the multi-talented Megan Choritz to discuss her novel, Lost Property. The two gathered on a rainy evening in the book lounge in Cape Town for an intimate conversation about her brilliant debut novel.
Director, vegan, anti-racist, tarot reader, improviser, performer, playwright, voiceover artist, director, industrial theatre specialist, the few words that came up, there were many more, and variously all sorts of other things in the socials, etc., etc. But formally, and I love this, on the back of the book, very thoughtfully, it says she has spent all of her life involved in making things up. So you can't believe a word she says. But you wonder to oneself, you know, where all this comes from, and all those things that you are, all those many hats that you wear. I think to myself, now where do those stop, and where does being a novelist start? And then I thought, they don't. Because what happens is that all those things come right in here into the book. And the other thing I love about the book lounge is that they're very thoughtful about their food. And the other, and all the food down here is vegan, is it not?
No. No.
And there were cupcakes with uteruses on them. So I thought it was very appetite that there should be food that matched the author. But anyway, forget all that because it's not true. So, Megan, aside from the fact that you know everybody and you've had a lifetime of making things up, you've also done all these other things, and you clearly have a prodigious memory, or if you haven't got a prodigious memory, you viscerally scraped it till you brought it right up to the surface. And I listed the things that, I'm going to stop talking in a minute, but it's nearly time for you to say something. I listed all the things that are in the book. There's marriage, there's broken marriage, there are birds, troubled parents, significant nanny, race confrontation, birds, food, adolescenthood, childhood, childlessness, child loss, birds, abortion, therapy, birds, madness, pet solace, birds. Did I mention birds? Birds, big time in the book. So I would like to know, as a start of the 10, I'm going to park that question. What I really want to know is, you spent your whole life making things up. Even when you were a kid? Were you a great maker-upper when you were a kid?
Yes. I absolutely was, and I was in my first improvised play when I was about 7. The neighbour across the road from me was a drama teacher, and so I just went to her house and kind of stayed there and made things up, and it was fantastic. So, and it was all improvised, we didn't have scripts, and I spent up until I was 16 with her.
Okay, so you were marked to be a maker-upper.
Yes.
Were you marked to be in the theatre? Was there a path laid out in front of you?
I think so. I think that's where that started.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've done that, and you've obviously helped an enormous amount of other people, because I keep talking to people who say, oh no, but I've been in an improv class with her, and I've done this, and she's done that, and helped me. Mm-hmm. So you've been very generous with your expertise and your making things up. And when I got the book in my hot hand, and I started to read it, and I thought, this isn't a novel. This has got to be true. It's got to be a memoir. So the little bird that sat on your shoulder and convinced you to write a book instead of another play or doing any other things, what was it saying?
So I had been doing a lot of self-work after my own particular sort of traumatic time, and also COVID and lockdown, and I knew that I wanted to write something, and I was doing online writing and writing short stories and poetry and stuff, and then I suddenly decided to write this. And I wrote it through this online group called Deadlines for Writers. And it was just the discipline. Sit down, write, submit once a week, and by the end of the year, there'll be a book.
The clue there, though, is I was doing some self-work.
Yes.
So was the writing a means of discovering a little bit more of the self? Or was it because you just fancied writing to fill the COVID time?
There was no fancy. It was digging deep. And the book itself is a result of two things, me and then also writing.
Okay. So well that explains an enormous amount. Go.
So I also just want to say it is a novel. It is fictionalized. Everything that I've drawn on is heavily mine, but all the feelings, everything that I feel is in the book, but not all the incidences are real.
Yeah. Okay.
I made them up.
Nonetheless. And there must have been a point at which you thought, okay, I've got all the ingredients, because you have got some ingredients. There must have been a point at which you thought, I'm going to make it real. I mean, did you ever think, no, damn it, I'm going to do the memoir? No. It was always going to be fictionalized.
It was always going to be fictionalized. It was always going to be fictionalized, even though when I started, I didn't have any idea what I was doing. It wasn't all perfect. I didn't have the plan. I didn't know it was going to be this.
Okay, so it was random. It's always interesting to find out how people put together a book, especially a book like this, and there are not many books like this, but a book like this that goes back and forth in time. It focuses on particular elements, and you know, one imagines fondly that you might have had, I'm going to put this bit in, and then I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to go back there. Very organized. So how did you actually embark on it? Did you have, there's you and there's writing, but did you have any sort of plot, start, middle, end in mind?
I after about the third or fourth part, I had a sense that I was in three places, or at least three times. So childhood, marriage, and post-marriage. And that was very useful for me when I discovered that. I didn't know that that's what was going to happen, but that did. That sort of happened, and then I was able to say, okay, well that slots into the childhood part, or that slots into the marriage part, or that's post-marriage. And so once I had that, even though it's not chronological, I knew I kind of had something to hang on to.
Yeah, and I can imagine that one thing led to another. It might have started with one little memory, but very soon it was pulling on all sorts of other things. So Lane, because I was listening to you on FMR this morning. I thought, oh my goodness, I know that voice. Mm-hmm. And Philip Todras said to you, what's it about? And I thought, this is going to be so interesting. Because what's it about? It's about so many things. But the protagonist is Lane.
Yes.
Which I'm getting is toi. You.
Ish. Me-ish.
But you were able to...
I mean, I'm writing it in first person, so yes. There is a lot of that.
Yes. But you were able to tweak her.
Yes.
You were able to work with her.
Yes.
So she started... And I love the thing that Melinda was referring to about... So there are not chapters, but parts. And it felt to me like perhaps as you were thinking about writing a book, it felt like that. So this is the part where it all falls apart, and this is the part where it all comes together. As a theatre maker, as somebody who works in that, did you think in terms of acts or parts?
I don't even really know where that happened. It became a device that was useful because it was both true and not true. And could live in between the space of being an unreliable narrator, you don't know if Lane necessarily tells the truth. Do we?
I trusted her implicitly.
Did you? Well, I don't mean that she lies. I mean that it's very much from her point of view.
Yes. Yes. Well, thank the Lord, it's not from Mark's point of view. Mark is the manipulative and dreadful husband.
Yes.
Nonetheless, would you like to read it, or shall I? Would you like to read it? You shall read it. Just read the glasses.
Yep.
Bring it while we get the glasses on. Because there are so many parts, and it looks a bit ostentatious, but they're all these little yellow things, because there are so many things that are so quotable that you can't sort of really remember off the top of your head. So this might not be the best part, but you can start with that one. That's just the opening line, isn't it?
This is the part of the story where I look for something to hold on to. It's an ugly part of the story, but it isn't the ugliest. It is the part where I move so slightly that it cannot be seen with the naked eye into the shadow of me.
There are many, each and every different part. You know, you think, oh, wait a minute, I just need to stop and think about that. I'm sorry to backtrack on you, but just tell me, did you have any writing training? I mean, we know about your making things up and the theatre being marked, but was there any sort of, apart from the deadlines, was it deadline 52?
Deadlines for writers, yeah.
Deadlines for writers. Was there any, did you do an MBA or any, whatever it is, in creative writing or any of those stuff?
No. I have just always written, and whether it's in plays or reviews or industrial theatre, or I've written a lot, so I think it's always been
a habit. Yeah. You've also clearly read a lot, because there are lots of references, and it's lovely when somebody references books from second-hand bookshops or this or that, and you think, oh yeah, I know that. So clearly your reading has reflected, as your own life has reflected in here, your reading has reflected in here. This is probably an end of the interview kind of a question, but is there anybody who's influenced you as a writer? Because having said that, this is a very unique book. I have not read anything quite like it, so you weren't thinking, I'm going to go that route.
To be absolutely honest with you, I really want to be writer Stephen King, kind of. I love Stephen King. I love the fact that he's just so completely tapped into nostalgia and fear in the most profound way. And I find that very exciting. But there are lots of writers that I do love that I don't want to emulate, but sort of enjoy being moved by. I mean, you remind me how much I love Jeanette Wilson. I love every word she makes. You know, she's.
So I'm glad you didn't write like Stephen King, because you would have had to kill all your darlings. And all your starving darlings. And that would have been a great pity. So let's start at the beginning, because having said that there's so much in it, it's hard to say the plot is this, because it goes to all sorts of different places. So let's start not at the beginning of the book, which has got this dreadful scene about this non-birthday party in a seedy seafood restaurant. It's just agony. It's just agony. Clearly you've seen, or they've all been there, or you know about those sort of things. So let's start with the childhood. Because childhood, child loss, child issues, all the things around childhood feels very strong for you.
Yes.
Did you have a very remarkable childhood? Was it something that you look back on, you know, with fears sort of slightly like this, or with joy?
I think it was absolutely a combination of them both, and I think that when you are living your childhood, you don't know any different. So that's how things are, and that was the world. And so I don't at all feel like I had a traumatic childhood, but there were incidents of trauma that are were so striking that don't leave you, that make you who you are, aren't they?
It's kind of been easy writing it, because first of all, and one of the things I also felt about your book is that it's one thing to write it, but first you have to remember it, and then you have to think it, and then you have to work with it, and then you have to write it. So you must have been through quite a lot of thinking and feeling before you got to the writing bit.
Sometimes I did the thinking and feeling and then got to the writing, and then sometimes I would absolutely be triggered by a memory and then have to work that in.
So a part of a childhood of parents, and I'm going to ask you the obvious question here. Merle and Larry was very, very challenging Merle, and the rather understanding but weaker Larry. Were they based on anybody you know?
Yes.
Want to expand?
They were based quite not so loosely on my parents. You know, I was able to really explore them in terms of the range of their nastiness or weakness or kindness. I was able to stretch that further and push them to extremes.
You know what they say about memoir and biography or autobiography, just wait till everybody's passed before you write it, because then you're just going to get into trouble. Don't want to put you in any difficult situation. Have they passed?
Yes.
Something's really sensitive and difficult to talk about, but you've worked with it, and it feels like you sort of, as they say in therapy, and we'll get to that in a minute, you've come to terms with it. Did you sort of, before they passed, were you able to have conversations with them and go through some of the stuff that it seems like you went through?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that the conversations that I was able to have were not necessarily conversations that in any way resolved stuff. But I think that we did get to know each other for who we were. Yeah. And I don't think that I'm like Lane. I think that she's quite far away from me in a lot of ways. As a character, I think, to be fair, my parents I was harder to manage sometimes than she would have been.
Confessions from the Lost Property Department. I've got all these little flyers, but it doesn't really matter. But just with reference to what Melinda was saying about your university days, there's a wonderful passage in here when you talk about your time at university. How was that? And was it something that you, or do you remember not very much of it? Was it something that you trawled a great deal for?
Yes.
All sorts of reasons.
Yes. So also, I mean, I think also that section, that university section, is definitely a composite of my own experience, but also of experiences that other people were going through at the time. I mean, I'm looking at you, Tony, and I'm remembering your Arnold Street house.
I was remembering the petticoats in
there. So, you know, they're drawn on other people's stuff as well, but definitely of the time.
There was a lot going on in those days.
There was a lot.
I mean, you know, we're talking about 85, I think it was. And clearly, you have developed a very strong sense of justice, racial injustice, whiteness and blackness are very strong in your activism, if I can call it that. Something that comes across, maybe embodied through, let's talk about Dora Modise, who is the nanny. Some crippling stories around Dora. Was there a Dora Modise, or is she a...
There was a Dora. There absolutely was. And it's such an interesting thing because on the one hand, I think that there's so many very important stories to be told in that way. But at the same time, I do hear my own inner voice saying, are you really going to write another story about the maid? And But the interesting thing here for me is the enormous, her enormous power. And our world, and introduction for Lane, and certainly in my case, differently to the world that existed that no one was looking at.
I'm very conscious of the fact that, you know, when people go and see a movie and then they're talking to somebody else who's seen the movie and other people are listening to them talking and going, what are they talking about? And you're probably thinking, what is the story? What are you going with this? But there is an amazing Dora story. There are two stories that I want to reference. There's a very, very sore Dora story. And there's a very sore story with your father and a kite in the park, which have racial incidents. Let's start with your father. With Larry's story and the kite in the park. Can you share that with us in a synopsis?
Larry takes Lane and her brother to the park because he can see that there's been, he arrives home and he takes them to the park because he can see that there's been chaos at home. And he's made a tissue paper and dowel stick kite, which they're flying, and there are these sort of horrible little teenagers who cause trouble with a black man who's literally just walking past, and Larry gets involved, and it's shocking, I think, for everybody.
It's one of those stories that you think, really? But really, and they still happen today. The other Dora story, which I found particularly, I mean, I have some sticky socks after I've read it. And again, maybe you should tell it, but the story is that Dora, who is the nanny, Lane's nanny, I'm hesitating to say your nanny, Lane's nanny, and Lane feels that Dora is hers, she's her mother, looking after her, she's her rock, she's everything. And then one day, Dora's own daughter comes to stay, with grievous consequences for young Lane, who just feels that her Dora is being stolen from her, and she's particularly mean to this little girl, to the point where the little girl, again, a bit of a spoiler, but it's just agony. Please tell me it wasn't true.
There are elements of it that were not true.
Fictionalized memoir, which means that it's your story and you can do with it what you want.
Autofiction.
There you go. Lovely. Thank you. Awesome. The other thing which is huge, and I think you've handled it in a way that's both sort of funny and very touching, is the therapy. And Graham, not his real name, who occurs every now and again. I mean, I was talking to somebody the other day who says, I absolutely do not do therapy, I'm never going to do therapy, it doesn't work for me, no, no, no. And eventually went, and it was wonderful. I imagine clearly you've done therapy somewhere along the line. What's your take on it? Did you find, I mean, you know, Lane is a bit ambivalent about the therapist who is himself extremely vulnerable. He keeps breaking down in tears, basically. So, you know, what's your take on therapy? I mean, has it worked for you?
Yes. It's. I mean, I think it was the right person, and I think it was at the right time. And this is really personal now, and sharing my own personal story. The work that I was doing with my therapist in therapy was such that she said, write the book.
Okay.
And I think that that's actually what granted me the permission.
Wow, that's a bit of a showstopper. Mm-hmm. So did it? Well, you know, I mean, it is. You know, people say that it's cathartic and it's helpful and it's an outpouring. Did it work? I mean, it feels to me like
it's ongoing.
Yes,
it's ongoing. But yes, it did work.
Yeah.
That and a few other things really worked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is it something that you shut your ears, my lord, or you might have all these people something descending on you? Is it something that you would recommend? That
therapy?
Well, no, well, writing the book to work through it. Again, it feels a little bit corny, but did it help?
So, yes. I think I was lucky though, because all of the things, so many things came together. It was a confluence of, let's say, therapy and also having our entire worlds change with COVID and lockdown and not knowing who we were anymore, and then trying to think about where we came from. And so I think it was a whole bunch of stuff that made it possible. Everything happened at the right place at the right time. And then of course the next step was saying to Melinda, when I was like three quarters of the way through,
but you also had help with that with your 52 community, what were they called?
Deadlines for Writers.
With Deadlines for Writers, but there was another writing group that you were working with.
This is them. So okay. It's basically, so there's all these different sections of it, but the big one is people who want to write a novel, you have to submit a certain amount of words a week online. And then by the end of that, you've got a novel.
Giving it to Melinda must have been one thing, because you know that she would be embracing something, the fact that she's your friend. But sharing all these stories, you know, I can't quite remember what substance it is, but there's something that is liquid until it hits the air and then it crystallizes. Did you know, pouring this out onto paper, which is just you and the paper, suddenly giving it to somebody else to read, did it crystallize, or did you think, how did it feel?
Both. Yeah. It felt like both things. There was definitely a sense of crystallization, and then there was also like, what have I done? You know? And I think that's inevitable.
Yeah.
With any writing, really.
Yes, I suppose so. I always imagine one has to be terribly confident to actually say, here it is, you know.
Yeah.
You put it out there, this is me. And in this case, you've been very confidently, not saying it's me, but it's there. Let's talk about the manipulative mark, which probably is the most, well, it's sort of shocking, there's shock horror, but he's a very closely examined character who has been really, really a very difficult man. It reminded me a little bit about Kathy Park Kelly's book,
Boiling
a Frog Slowly, where she describes it, and I think, you know, you went through all that, and it's only on reflection that you can look back at it and you think, what a rat, you know, whereas at the time you're thinking, it's my fault. Is it something, I mean, how hard was it to go through all those awfulnesses and think, it wasn't my fault, this is what happened?
I think that when you're trying to find the creative voice for it, you get a certain amount of distance. And then you also get that place where you can play. And you can take something that was real and make it worse. You can take something that was real and leave it out. And put something else in its place.
So you could, yes, you could go back to the sort of the moulding, the
manipulation. You manipulate, exactly. So I think I had a clear message around Mark, and I think that I was quite deliberate in choosing how I was going to make him live.
We're going to park Mark.
Yes, let's.
There are so many things, did I mention the birds? Let's talk about the birds, because aside from the little birds that say, come on, you can do this, write this book. This whole book is a flutter with birds,
yes.
And the birds feel to me, it's a bit like Hitchcock's the birds everywhere. They sort of akin to a little bit of madness. Birds, and you're very knowledgeable. I mean, who knew about the Twee Waxfield? Really not me. So, you know, there are all sorts of starlings and darlings, and you call them thought birds and thought crows. And, yuck, these birds. What is it with the birds in your life?
So I think it's a couple of things. I mean, I think I did grow up noticing birds, and definitely my own father was someone who was aware of birds and pointed them out, and on trips to the game reserve there were always the birds. They were so amazing. And so that was I grew to have quite an active, practical interest in birds. I mean, hoopoes in German, hoopoes are just, you know, they come and visit, and it's so fantastic. So I think that there was a natural thing about the birds, but then also in mysticism and in tarot, and very much in tarot, you know, the bird as messenger, the bird that crosses paths, the bird that moves from spiritual and past into present and future and delivers messages. And for me, there is a very weird relationship with birds and their symbols and their significance and the way that they integrate in our cities and the way that they exist and have these completely other lives. So I've got a preoccupation with birds. And then of course what happens? My publisher saves a 3-day-old bird and grows it.
That's messy.
So I don't know how those things happen, but
and I'm sorry, you'll have to forgive me scratching away here. Of course, I can't find it, but there's a wonderful piece. Again, you can perhaps relate the story more fully when Lane is a child, and Merle says, I can't be having these pine trees in the garden anymore. They've got to go. And Larry says, but that's why we bought the house. No, they've got to go. And poor Lane comes home from school, and there are these buzzers, and all these pine trees are... And I can't find it, but there's the most wonderful passage where not only the pine trees come down, but the air is filled with birds with nowhere to go. And it's just absolutely, you have a very strong visual imagination, which makes me feel that maybe you go off sometimes into another place. As you were writing, do you sometimes go elsewhere?
Yes. I don't know what that place is, and I don't know what the name of that place is. It does feel like that. I mean, I think that that is the world of making things up, where anything is possible, and it's quite fragile and quite dangerous and very vulnerable, because it's also very open, and weird things can happen.
And it's a line between sanity and madness.
I think that's one part of it. And the other part of it is, I think that it's quite... surreal, other world stuff.
Other world, you mentioned that Dora was part of another world, and she does in fact come to visit from another world, from another place. But you yourself, because you're a tarot reader, I get the feeling, I mean, if I were a clairvoyant, I'd be reading your aura or something like that. are you very involved in the other world? I mean, there is a point, again, stop spoiling, but there is a point where you are listening to the voices of women from another world. Are you a little otherworldly?
I don't know.
Yes.
Okay, right. Are you telling me it's time to...
Maybe you can start talking to the audience.
Okay. Before I do any more spoilers, yes, let's do that. I do indeed have many more things that we could touch on, but let's open it up for questions. Oh, look at this, a flurry of wings. In the back there, let's start at the back and move forward.
Lady Madison, I'm so excited and proud and inspired by you. And my question, and I know definitely what I'm doing tonight, I'm not sleeping, because I'm reading a book. My question's got two parts, and you don't have to answer the second one if you don't want to. But my first one is, as a theatre maker, so often the audience is they're the people that we consider. So how would you like people to engage with your book? How do you want them, what do you want them to think about when they're done, or what's your desire response quietly in your heart? And the second part is, as a work of autofiction, what are you scared of? What were some of your fears before this came out?
So, ironically, they're actually the same thing, because when you transition from theatre or film to giving people your words that they take away, you have less control over the, I don't know, the shape of it, the style of it. So people are going to visualize it themselves. They're going to see their own pictures. They're going to create their own worlds. And that for me is thrilling, really, really exciting. And what I'm frightened of, it's not really fear, but there is an enormous vulnerability. So you're literally split open when your words exist outside of you and you're not necessarily saying them or performing them or getting other people to perform them. Having said that, I am interestingly more confident about the words in the book than I am about the theatrical space. I don't know why. I mean, maybe it's because I've arrived here now, after all this other work, doing all this other stuff. Does that answer it?
Yes. I always wonder to myself how much it matters what other people think about the book. What matters is what the publisher thinks and make sure it gets out there. But I wonder how much it matters. Was it something you thought about? Sorry, next question. Was it something you thought about as you were writing?
Definitely. Yes. I mean, I want people to like it.
I love it.
I definitely thought about it.
Yeah.
I imagine people reading it. Nicola.
I can't even stop. Sorry. Maybe does the writing make you discover what you think? And I mean, instead of thinking beforehand, does the writing make you discover what you think, and then also discover what you could think, and in a way, then make you fix yourself? It's almost like therapy, but it's not. It's fiction.
Very much so. And I think actually the spaces where you allow yourself to actually be imaginative and go with the imagination, what if, how could that, is where your voice of fixing comes, where you can really, and sometimes that will happen first, you'll think, okay, let me try that, or sometimes you'll write and you're like, oh, that's what that part did, you know? So I think it's both.
I can't wait to read the book. I was overseas, in fact, when I got the invitation, so I made sure that I was going to be here today. You make it sound a little easy. You just had to write whatever the number of words were for a week and submit it online after a year of the book. I'm sure it's a bit of a book. Because there would have been weeks, perhaps, where you were not finding the words. It was too difficult. It was too heartbreaking. The memories that were being triggered were just too much to process. When you found yourself in those weeks, what did you do to give you the courage, I suppose, to work through the heart rendering moments in order for you to actually create something? Because you didn't have a deadline for that.
I think there were two things that I did. I wrote something else or something else, like a movie review or even a theatre review, I wrote something else and then came back to it. But I think that I was aware that a lot of the stuff was really weak. And so I also really wanted to make sure that there was stuff that wasn't that, and that definitely had a thread of hope or a different feeling as well. And so sometimes when I couldn't, I would go to that place. And the birds definitely help me with that.
Can I just add on to that? One of the other things I felt was that when you got to the end,
You must have been heartbroken. I was. And you talk about, you know, bleak things that happen. And I, you know, at the end, it's less bleak, no spoilers, but it's less bleak at the end. And I thought, gosh, you've been through all this. You've remembered all this. You've found all this stuff and poured it all out. It must have been quite amputating when it was all finished. You know, suddenly, that's it. Goodbye. Over to you, Melinda. Did you feel a little bit bereft?
Not
or
at
was
all.
She very fierce with you?
She was very fierce with me in the most magnificent way. I mean, Melinda is ride or die. She's on your side.
Yeah.
Every word is like the best one. And she's quite strict and well, and she's, yeah, no, I mean, so.
Megan was an absolute fucking pleasure. An absolute pleasure, one of the finest, one of the most deadline driven, the most beautiful soul to work with.
Aww. Well, Kat, seeing as you're holding the floor, let me just ask you, how much did you need to change? Or did you indeed take it?
Listen, guys, I put it on my face now, but no, I won't. I'll just show you all. There are books that I get when I fucking rewrite them. I mean, honestly, I'm not mentioning names here, but there are a lot of books I get that I'm not ready to publish, and you're kind of in that space where something has to happen. I'm on a deadline. I'll just put it on you. And basically, when I got Megan's book, one of the things that drew me to her was that could find nothing wrong. And I mean, when I got really pedantic, I argued about a word. I said maybe Graham would not use real name, wouldn't do that. He had very, very few suggestions actually compared to what I usually do. So Megan's book for me was almost print perfect when I got it.
Sometimes there are repetitions and there's an I remember and I remember. And I have this feeling of poetry turned prose. Are you a little bit of a poet monkey? You know, there's a little bit of poetry going on here.
I mean, I love the notion of prose that is poetic. And I love that style of writing. So I think that sometimes
Hello. I'm interested to know, in the process of you submitting once a week, was it just a matter of so many words, press send and start on the next week, or was there a feedback, and if so, did you have time to then work on that and resubmit, or what was that? Was it like a kind of ongoing mini editing going on?
So you submit and you've got a certain amount of readers and you have to read a certain amount of people's work. So there are readers giving you feedback and you're giving other people feedback. But the woman who runs the website, Mia, she recommends that you don't make any changes until you go into your rewrite. So you've got all the comments that people have made, and then you can, once you've got a whole book, you can go back and decide whether or not you want to make those changes or not. But it's a very supportive, it's a brilliant environment. Because you're engaging, it's wonderful. Does that answer your question?
In that process of deadlines, did you have a sense of pretty much chronology, but certainly one group would follow the next? Not at all. So you would, it would be random and haphazard, and a thought would come and you'd submit it.
Okay.
So at the end, did that sequence of writing, did that change entirely? Did you sort of shift things around?
I did shift a little bit of stuff around, just in terms of balance, so that it didn't feel like we were spending too much time in early childhood and then too much time in in the kind of post-marriage section. So there was a little bit of jiggling around, but mostly I would have a kind of feeling that I wanted to spend time in one or two, in one or the other of those environments, and then I would write. I often had more to write than I could submit.
That's what I would like to say. I feel that there is a lot more. I mean, interrogated your life as you have, both for the book and in the process of writing the book. Do you think you might do more? Has this got you started now?
It has, but I don't think that I'll write something similar. I think I would like to write something completely different. And I want to keep on going.
Actually, that was going to be my question. Great to read this, and I'm just so excited. I can't believe it's a new novel. My question is that what Nancy just asked you, and it's, has the process of, especially this first novel, if you like, being not autobiographical, fictionalized, right? That process of fictionalizing going forward, what question one is, how does it have you thinking about your favorite authors, having used that process and that tool to create a work of fiction? And how going forward would you approach something completely, not personalised, but imagined, perhaps from the birds directly? That's really my question.
I'm currently working on a thing. I'm working on something at the moment that's very, very different. And having done this, the only thing that I'm taking from this into that is confidence.
Right.
That I'm confidently able to do it.
And what do you think of Jeanette now?
She's amazing. She's amazing.
The only line that I've managed to retrieve from all these little things is that your style is just this one phrase that says, "Her thoughts crash into each other, a dodging car circuit of thoughts." I thought that was so lovely.
Thank you.
And I just had to ask about the cover. It's very difficult to be original. Look around you. How easy is it to come up with something completely different? But this is it's so different as a cover. Can you explain more about it?
Yes. We went through some stuff, and then Melinda made the cover.
What I really want to be is a cover designer.
And, I mean, there was a bit of tweaking and a little bit of art direction or stuff, but Melinda took the photograph, Melinda...
I lay on my kitchen counter. There's a sort of one of those things you hang things on. The bird is actually on the top, the real bird. The bird came to this place with me. And then we superimposed Messi a more clear picture. But if you look very carefully on the top, there's little Messi, probably about 4 months old, sitting up there watching us.
I love this cover. I'm obsessed with this cover.
I love this book. Megan, thank you.
We love it.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of NB Publishers Book Nook. Until next time, and happy reading!